I was interested to hear your thoughts. And about a year ago, I spoke with Jackson Brown, and he was telling me about a song of his called The Birds of St. Mark's. And he said to me, I started writing that when I was 17. And he said, I could never finish it. I never had a way to get into the song in a way that I was happy with. And he said, I'm now 67 or whatever he was at the time. And he said, I found a way to finish it. I mean, have you ever had that sort of thing where there's been a nagging idea from way, way back? And you go, now I...
Well,
now,
absolutely. You know, I call them my unfinished, you know, pregnancies. You know, you run off with an idea, and it goes like blazes for a couple of days, and then all of a sudden, wham, you hit a wall, and it's like, oh, my God, you know, what happened? I had so much momentum, and I thought I knew where I was going, and now I can't find my way to the end. I don't know what the end is. And, you know, it's like always saying, and you'll hear this very common complaint among songwriters is that the first verse is easy, the second verse is hell. So yes, I mean, I've got some unfinished hulks, you know, littering the highway behind me. Sometimes I go back, I look at one of those songs, and I go, you know, this song wasn't as hard as I thought it was. All I need to do is tweak this and tweak this, and in retrospect, probably the best thing that one can do is to just leave it behind, and then maybe come back and look at it sometime. Come back and look at it, and it may just fall into place, you know. And it sounds like something similar might have happened to Jackson, and who I know very well, and who I talk about it a little bit in my book, The Cake and the Rain. The first time I met him, he was staying in David Geffen's house, and I had stayed in that house when I was a contract writer for Johnny Rivers. It was Johnny Rivers' house. And Jackson was sitting on the rug cross-legged, and David said to him, play opening Farewell, and I saw this kid for the first time, you know, with these huge brown, you know, expressive eyes and long hair, and just crouching over this guitar. And he played this song that was like 150 years old. You know, it was like just one of the, you know, one of the most profound, moving things I'd ever heard. And I thought, well, I'll get out of this kid's way, you know, because he's going to be writing. And I was actually, when he was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, I was chairman. And I was standing at the end of the red carpet when he came down the line shaking hands, and I was the first person to shake his hand and say, congratulations, I knew you were going to be here one day. And I did. So, I mean, I look back and I kind of savor those moments, you know, because I saw a lot of stuff happen.
I was going to ask you.
It was exciting. It was moving. To be involved with music and to know the people who created music, sometimes to know them well, sometimes not so well, you know, and you can't be friends with everyone. But by and large, it's been a really good experience, very fulfilling and very much like what I imagined it was going to be like when I was growing up with this, you know, foolhardy dream. I thought, but wouldn't it be great if it worked out? And, you know, I've been able to do this for a long time now without actually doing any work. And so I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that playing music has been my only visible means of support.
I was going to ask you, Jimmy, that I mean, you just talked about, you know, Johnny Rivers' house and Geffen and Jackson Brown. I mean, you know, you'd moved to Los Angeles in the mid-60s, and you were around in that 60s, 70s period, which is much mythologized, particularly for people who weren't around then. I mean, was it as free and wonderful and naive and innocent as what sometimes we're led to believe? Or was there a darker edge to what was going on at the time?
Well, I think that, you know, the Cake and the Rain makes it very, very clear, mm-hmm. because you can read the Cake and the Rain in the other way, which is like the good and the bad,
mm-hmm.
Or the positive and the negative. Yes, it was all of that. It was innocent. The California dream was like a real thing. Just like the feeling I get when I go to Australia is a very real thing. It's like, my God, you know, you could move here. You could start over. You could you could change your life. You know, you feel that. And so, you know, that's what I felt when I arrived in California in the summer of 1962,
mm-hmm.
And started high school at Colton High, and it was Beach Boys music floating from window to window in suburbia, you know, and the sound of the hissing of summer lawns, Joni Mitchell said, the sprinklers going, and the bougainvillea, and the palm trees, and it was like, wow. You know, for a kid who grew up in western Oklahoma...
It's very different.
You know, which is tantamount to the outback.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, you know, here's California blooming. And I remember the big song was In My Room. And I got a serious case of the California flu. You know, I wanted to make that dream come true, and I think I was fortunate. I was able to actually make a lot of that mythological California dream, and the innocence you speak of, and the sort of dazzle, the Disney girls, the you know, the fun till your daddy takes your T-Bird away. I was able to do a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side of the coin, there was a world that was at the end of the 60s, well, the book starts in 1969,
mm-hmm.
A world that was very rapidly infiltrated by not very attractive drugs like cocaine and a kind of rougher way of doing business, and also, at the same time, the record business was becoming a big corporate thing. It was kind of losing some of its quaintness and charm. I mean, the record labels used to be like cottage industries, like World Pacific used to be like a little tiny jazz label, and with maybe three or four artists, and you would sell. A hit album would be 20,000 copies, and everyone would go home happy. Well, those days were over.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, it was like, well, you got to have a million seller. And then it was, you got to have a platinum seller. And I think that really the sort of official end and the sort of invocation, if you will, on the California Dreamin' era was probably Michael Jackson's Thriller album. From then on, it was big business.
Wow, that's interesting. Right.
And it was big business, and it was MTV, and it was, you know, it was something that sort of happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think we all became a little bit jaded and we lost, I don't know, we lost some of the magic.
Mm-hmm. And with your book, I mean, you spent, you know, 2.5, you know, years going back. Was it a pleasurable experience, just, you know, taking yourself back to write through this whole period? Are there bits you...
Well, there were times that it would knock me flat.
Yeah.
Because I would be, like, riding along, and I would go, oh, my God. You did this. You actually did this, you know, because you can't, there's something about writing something down that makes one tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, if you're only going to have one shot at this, you don't want it to be a lie, and you don't want it to be a, you know, I don't want it colored to make me look better. You know, if anything, I was bending over the other way and trying to highlight my own foolishness as much as I possibly could, because I behave like an absolute ass a lot of the time. You know, I was dating married women, and I was doing things like that. You know, that even, I mean, if you read the Playboy philosophy, even Hugh Hefner said, "Don't date married women." You know, even Hugh Hefner knew. I would say a quasi nervous breakdown. Right at the very beginning, because I didn't really have my feet under me, and I was up in Maine by myself at a cabin, and it all just rushed in on me. It was like almost like my whole life passed before me. And my daughter was up there, who has a degree in psychology, and had just graduated from Berklee College, and I love her dearly. She's my only girl. I have five boys and a girl. And one day I just said to her, "Honey, will you take me home?" And she said, "Sure, Dad." And so she and I drove home together, and I was just, I honestly didn't know whether I was going to be able to do this project or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of got back with my therapist and did some work and thought through it again and climbed back on the horse and finished it.
Mm.
And that was one thing that I was taught when I was a kid, was to finish things.
Right.
You just plow half the cotton patch and then say, "Oh, well, I've had enough of that," and go back to the barn and put the tractor away.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of grew up with that kind of, I would call it stubbornness, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's been a friend at times, and obviously there are times when being stubborn is not an attribute.
Right.
But I finished it. And I actually wrote 300,000 words, and it was edited to 120,000 words.
It's
I'm ready to write another one now, because I'm used to telling the truth, and I know that nothing can hurt me.
Mm-hmm.